Chapter 11. Sir, if after our long and intimate friendship you can for a moment deem me capable of so base a treachery, tut, tut. What words are these, my dear friend? Have I wounded you? Ah, forgive me, I am overloading you with labor. Therefore go on with the other details, and drop this one from your list. The bloody-minded flirt who will be sure to attend to it. Or I myself, yes, to make certain, I will drop a note to my journalistic friend, M.Y.O. Come to think of it, you may save yourself the trouble. That other second has informed M.Y.H.M. I might have known it. It is just like that flirt who always wants to make a display. At 9:30 in the morning the procession approached the field of Plessis Picket in the following order. First came our carriage, nobody in it, but M. Gambetta and myself, then a carriage containing M. Furtu and his second, then a carriage containing two poet orators who did not believe in God, and these had M.S. funeral orations projecting from their breast pockets, then a carriage containing the head surgeons and their cases of instruments, then eight private carriages containing consulting surgeons, then a hack containing a coroner, then the two hearses, then a carriage containing the head undertakers, then a train of assistants and mutes on foot, and after these came plodding through the fog a long procession of camp followers, police, and citizens generally. It was a noble turnout, and would have made a fine display, if we had had thinner weather. There was no conversation. I spoke several times to my principal, but I judge he was not aware of it, for he always referred to his notebook and muttered absently, "I die that France might live." Arrived on the field, my fellow second, and I paced off the 35 yards, and then drew lots for choice of position. This latter was but an ornamental ceremony, for all the choices were alike in such weather. These preliminaries being ended, I went to my principal, and asked him, if he was ready. He spread himself out to his full width, and said in a stern voice, "Ready. Let the batteries be charged." The loading process was done in the presence of duly constituted witnesses. We considered it best to perform this delicate service with the assistance of a lantern, on account of the state of the weather. We now placed our men. At this point the police noticed that the public had massed themselves together on the right and left of the field. They therefore begged a delay, while they should put these poor people in a place of safety. The request was granted. The police having ordered the two multitudes to take positions behind the duelists, we were once more ready. The weather growing still more opaque, it was agreed between myself and the other second, that before giving the fatal signal we should each deliver a loud whoop, to enable the combatants to ascertain each other's whereabouts. I now returned to my principal, and was distressed to observe that he had lost a good deal of his spirit. I tried my best to hearten him. I said, "Indeed, sir, things are not as bad as they seem. Considering the character of the weapons, the limited number of shots allowed, the generous distance, the impenetrable solidity of the fog, and the added fact that one of the combatants is one-eyed and the other cross-eyed and near-sighted, it seems to me that this conflict need not necessarily be fatal. There are chances that both of you may survive. Therefore, cheer up. Do not be downhearted." This speech had so good an effect that my principal immediately stretched forth his hand and said, "I am myself again. Give me the weapon." I laid it, all lonely and forlorn, in the center of the vast solitude of his palm. He gazed at it and shuddered. And still mournfully contemplating it, he murmured in a broken voice, "Alas, it is not death I dread, but mutilation." I heartened him once more, and with such success, that he presently said, "Let the tragedy begin. Stand at my back. Do not desert me in this solemn hour, my friend." I gave him my promise. I now assisted him to point his pistol toward the spot where I judged his adversary to be standing, and cautioned him to listen well, and further guide himself by my fellow second's whoop. Then I propped myself against M. Gambetta's back, and raised a rousing whoopee. This was answered from out the far distances of the fog, and I immediately shouted, 1, 2, 3, fire! Two little sounds like spit, spit, broke upon my ear, and in the same instant I was crushed to the earth under a mountain of flesh. Bruised as I was still able to catch a faint accent from above, to this effect. I die for. ... Perdition take it, what is it I die for? ... Yes, France. I die that France may live. The surgeons swarmed around with their probes in their hands, and applied their microscopes to the whole area of M. Gambetta's person, with the happy result of finding nothing in the nature of a wound. Then a scene ensued which was in every way gratifying and inspiriting. The two gladiators fell upon each other's neck, with floods of proud and happy tears. That other second embraced me. The surgeons, the orators, the undertakers, the police, everybody embraced, everybody congratulated, everybody cried, and the whole atmosphere was filled with praise, and with joy unspeakable. It seems to me then, that I would rather be a hero of a French duel than a crowned and sceptered monarch. When the commotion had somewhat subsided, the body of surgeons held a consultation, and after a good deal of debate decided that with proper care and nursing there was reason to believe that I would survive my injuries. My internal hurts were deemed the most serious, since it was apparent that a broken rib had penetrated my left lung, and that many of my organs had been pressed out so far to one side or the other of where they belonged, that it was doubtful if they would ever learn to perform their functions in such remote and unaccustomed localities. They then set my left arm in two places, pulled my right hip into its socket again, and re-elevated my nose. I was an object of great interest, and even admiration, and many sincere and warm-hearted persons had themselves introduced to me, and said they were proud to know the only man who had been hurt in a French duel in 40 years. I was placed in an ambulance at the very head of the procession, and thus with gratifying eclat I was marched into Paris, the most conspicuous figure in that great spectacle, and deposited at the hospital. The cross of the Legion of Honor has been conferred upon me. However, few escaped that distinction. Such is the true version of the most memorable private conflict of the age. I have no complaints to make against anyone. I acted for myself, and I can stand the consequences. Without boasting, I think I may say I am not afraid to stand before a modern French duelist, but as long as I keep in my right mind I will never consent to stand behind one again. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.